From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the NATO ultimatum to the Serbs. Why have some countries pushed for military intervention while others resisted until now? We'll talk with Charles Kupchan, an expert on European affairs with the Council on Foreign Relations. Also, an actress who was groomed to be a Chinese film star. An Chi Min was starring in Madame Mao's opera Red Azalea. But while the opera was still in production, Madame Mao was denounced, and that was the end of the film and An Chi Min's acting career. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Romeo is Bleeding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A ceasefire around Sarajevo has gone into effect. French peacekeepers are taking up positions to monitor the truce between the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian government. The French have been told to fire back if they are attacked. The ceasefire offered by the Bosnian Serbs came just hours before NATO decided to give them an ultimatum to pull back their heavy weapons from around the city in the next 10 days. NATO says it will use airstrikes if the Serbs don't comply. Russia is calling for a meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss yesterday's NATO ultimatum. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
According to a spokesman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, Russia wants an emergency session of the Security Council to discuss, in his words, ways of demilitarizing Sarajevo and introducing direct UN rule there. This is a proposal that Russia is floating as a means of preventing NATO airstrikes around Sarajevo. The spokesman said the ultimatum from NATO that the Bosnian Serbs must pull back their artillery from around the city was made outside the framework of the UN. Earlier, reported comments from a deputy foreign minister were sharper. Why should NATO decide, this official is reported to have said, especially by ultimatums and threats to use force? This is not NATO's business, the official continued. It's the job of the UN. Since last Saturday's deadly mortar attack in Sarajevo, the Russian government has been extremely active in trying to prevent NATO airstrikes. Some Russian leaders have even said such action could trigger a world war. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
General Motors today became the latest U.S. automaker to report healthy profits during the fourth quarter. The world's largest auto manufacturer earned $1.2 billion for the period. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Earlier, Chrysler and Ford reported big profits for the fourth quarter and for all of 1993. Now General Motors follows suit. Most significant for GM is that during the fourth quarter, GM made money, $427 million, on its core North American car and truck business. That holds billions of dollars worth of red ink in that category in recent years. For all of 1993, GM was $2.5 billion in the black, roughly the same level of earnings reported by Ford and Chrysler. GM's profit margins, however, are not nearly as strong as its domestic competitors, and the company is still struggling to make its operations more efficient. The real strength of GM's balance sheet was its European automotive operations and its non-automotive subsidiaries, including Electronic Data Systems and GMAC, its new car financing arm. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
AT&T says it's cutting between 14 and 15,000 jobs over the next 2 years. The giant communications firm says the move will save $900 million each year. AT&T says more than half of the cuts will come from managers in its long-distance business. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen nearly 36 points to 3,896. The Nasdaq is down 3 at 783. This is NPR. The House of Representatives has voted to renew the expired independent counsel law. This lets a court-appointed investigator conduct criminal investigations of high government officials. Democrats defeated a Republican attempt to have all criminal investigations of lawmakers handled by the neutral prosecutor. The House instead supported a Democratic plan that gives the Attorney General discretion to have the Justice Department look into the matter of power to apply, power to apply for an independent counsel. The House Ways and Means Committee heard today from two men who are serving time in prison for preparing fraudulent tax returns. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The two men warned the Congressional Tax Writing Committee that the Internal Revenue Service is a tempting target for fraudulent schemes. They say the increasing use of computerized filing has made their former line of work easier. Todd Frazier has been in jail since April of 1992. He told lawmakers he would recruit people from public housing projects, use their real Social Security numbers, and then take advantage of IRS regulations designed to reduce paperwork.
The Internal Revenue Service has a provision whereby new employer identification numbers can be issued and obtained over the telephone in less than 5 minutes.
The IRS commissioner told the panel that her agency is working to prevent tax fraud and punish those who try it. But she admitted that as quickly as the IRS figures out how to block one type of scheme, criminals seem to come up with a new one. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has briefed Jordan's King Hussein on the new PLO-Israeli agreement. Arafat says a final draft of the Cairo Accord will be signed after negotiators from both sides meet again in Egypt. The king says he's satisfied and is expressing his support for the Palestinians. The new agreement settles some security matters that have blocked the startup of Palestinian self-rule. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Serbs now face NATO's ultimatum: pull back heavy artillery about 12.5 miles from the center of Sarajevo or face airstrikes. Last week's shelling of the marketplace in Sarajevo was surely an incentive for action. The city has been under siege for close to 2 years. We invited an expert on European affairs to help us understand why some NATO countries have been in favor of intervention while others have resisted until now. Charles Kupchan just joined the Council on Foreign Relations as Senior Fellow for Europe. Before that, he was Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. NATO was founded in 1949 to defend Europe against the Soviet Union. An airstrike against the Serbs would be the first NATO attack ever. I asked Kupchan if he thinks the NATO ultimatum could redefine the nature of the alliance.
I think that one of the issues that's at stake here, if not the most important issue, is the character of Europe in the post-Cold War era and the norms of behavior and in the institutions that are going to guide the creation of new states and relations among states. And in discussing the Bosnia conflict, many analysts and scholars have talked about the importance of reputation, that if we don't stand firm here, what's going to happen in North Korea, what's going to happen in other parts of the former Soviet Union. And I think that almost more important than that is what would happen to the Western alliance, what would happen to norms of multilateral efforts to prevent aggression and to protect human rights. And so I think what is in many respects the most important outcome of this decision could be a reinvigoration of the sense that NATO and like-minded members, because even though NATO will be acting in this case, there now exists a partnership for peace, which brings other East European countries into the NATO family, that this decision could push forward the sense that NATO and like-minded nations will take a proactive role in attempting to create a post-Cold War era in Europe characterized by cooperation and ethnic tolerance and the survival of multi-ethnic communities.
A while back in the New Yorker magazine, Sidney Blumenthal wrote that the two metaphors that people in the United States use to frame the issue of intervention in Bosnia is one, the Holocaust, and the idea of never again, therefore we must intervene. But on the other hand, the other metaphor is of Vietnam, that you risk getting into a quagmire that we'll never get out of and that won't really solve anything. Are the metaphors in Europe any different?
Well, I think that those two metaphors have some purchase, provide some insight, but they're also misleading in the following sense, that the Holocaust was obviously a case of gross genocide, and in this case, genocide is taking place, and there is a moral outrage that is the basis, to some extent, for collective action. On the other hand, Serbia is not a power on par with Nazi Germany. Serbia does not pose a major threat to the stability of Europe in the same way that Germany did, and therefore the two instances are not entirely correct. I think that Vietnam is less appropriate as a historical analogy because we often draw the wrong lesson. I think the lesson that the military tends to draw is that regional conflicts of this sort, in which civil wars exist, in which there are ethnic conflicts, tend to turn into quagmires, and that the United States cannot but get drawn into such a quagmire. And in my mind, the lesson from Vietnam is not that we got involved, because probably we should have, but that we got involved far too deeply. And the trick here, in my mind, in Bosnia, is to get involved in a level that is consistent with American interests and European interests, NATO interests, and to try to find that fine line. That's not easy, but I think it can be done.
Do you have a sense of what the kind of guiding metaphors are in Europe?
Well, I think that that the 1930s keep coming back for many reasons. One, we've discussed, and that's the Holocaust and the emergence right in the center of Europe of ethnic cleansing and of slaughter based upon ethnicity. And the other is the extent to which in the 1930s there were fledgling democracies that were attempting to survive, Weimar Germany and even outside of Europe and Japan. And because in part of the Depression, these fledgling democracies didn't make it, they were overtaken by militarists, nationalists. And in many respects, those conditions that led to the emergence of militarism and nationalism exist in spades, not just in the former Yugoslavia, but in many parts of the former Soviet bloc. So I think lurking behind the day-to-day discussions on Bosnia is what can be done in the long term to try to prevent a repeat of the 1930s and to ensure that these fledgling democracies, in fact, move towards stable market democracy and not towards militaristic, nationalistic countries.
France and the United States led the move to present the Serbs with an ultimatum. Both President Clinton and France had flip-flopped on this issue. Why was France spearheading this last week?
Well, I think that the relationship between the United States and France in the context of NATO and European security is a very complicated one. The French, in some respects, are a very natural ally of the U.S. because they have the ability to project power because of their experience as an empire, a colonial empire. They are interested in maintaining a hand in determining political outcomes on the periphery of the core of Europe. On the other hand, they distanced themselves from NATO. They withdrew from the integrated military structure in the 1960s, in part because they saw NATO as an instrument of American domination. The French, I think, are very clearly upset by the slaughter in the former Yugoslavia. But this also provides an opportunity for France to establish itself as a leading country in shaping the post-Cold War order in Europe. And in many ways, I think this is an opening gambit of a rejiggering, if you will, of the relations among European states and their relationship to NATO now that the Soviet threat is gone.
Well, England was resisting intervention. Is this kind of changing the relationship between the United States and France and the United States and England?
I think that relationship would have changed regardless of the conflict in Bosnia, in large part because of the end of the Cold War. Britain's special position vis-a-vis NATO was to some extent diminished because of the end of the Cold War. France and Germany are becoming more important players. And I think that even though both France and Britain have troops in UNPROFOR, the French have been more interested and are more willing to engage in military action, in large part because of this desire to play a larger role, if not the dominating role in shaping European security architecture. And the Germans, even though they are a very wealthy country with significant military capability, cannot play this role because of historical baggage, because they constitutionally, as a result of World War II, are not able to send their troops to carry out missions other than the defense of German territory. So in many respects, France emerges as the natural leader of European security issues now that the Cold War is over.
What's at stake for France in the former Yugoslavia? What has the French relationship been with the Balkans, and what are its fears? What are its motivations?
Well, I think that all European countries, and the French and the Germans in particular, have had long historical ties to the Balkans. The Balkans have been a tinderbox in Europe for a long time, beginning with the Ottoman Empire and the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. Obviously, World War I was triggered in that part of the world. And therefore, each of these countries brings a lot of historical weight to the table. But I think that much more important in the short term in understanding how these countries are behaving is this question of recreating a European security architecture. And in that respect, the French have always been pushing for the creation of a strong Western European Union, one that stands alongside NATO, that does not compete with NATO, but that would allow the Europeans to take action, if necessary, on their own.
How worried are European countries that the war in the Balkans would spread and become a larger European war?
I think that everybody is concerned about that. There is, I think, some optimism that comes from the fact that American troops, along with Nordic troops and others, have been deployed in Macedonia in a preventive capacity. But it's clearly lurking in the back of the minds of Europeans. I think of more immediate importance are refugee flows, and refugees are already pouring out of the Balkans, straining the capacity of states to integrate them. Secondly, that all of these countries are facing very difficult times politically and economically. Economic growth in Europe is hovering at about zero. Almost every political regime, if you go from country to country in Europe, is weak, is enjoying low popularity ratings. And so I think they're concerned, number one, about the economic strains and political strains associated with refugee flows, but more importantly, about how this conflict is affecting their already fragile political situation and the tenuous coalitions that have emerged. And in many respects, what I think has happened here over the last few days, both vis-a-vis Europe and in the United States, is that political decision makers have begun to say that the political costs of doing nothing are now beginning to look greater than the political costs of engaging and using air power. And that's what's really new here. And if you look at public opinion polls, if you look at what parliamentarians in this country and in Europe are saying, they are now backing intervention and airstrikes in a manner that they have not heretofore.
What do you think is at stake for America? And, I mean, obviously there's the humanitarian impulse. It's so difficult to watch, to witness what's happening in Sarajevo. But what do you think is at stake for America?
I think that that part of it is a question of morality and stopping the genocide which is occurring. But obviously then you get into the question of double standards. And if we mm-hmm. intervene in Bosnia, then why don't we do so in Southeast Asia or in parts of Africa mm-hmm. where similar types of conflicts are taking place? And there I think you do have to come back to Europe. And to the fact that Europe still remains the linchpin of American foreign policy. And whether it's completing the Uruguay round of trade negotiations, bringing peace to the Middle East, monitoring elections in South Africa, it is the U.S.-European alliance. It is the transatlantic partnership that is the core of that. And that's why I think we need to go further to preserve peace and promote democracy in Europe than in some other areas of the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charles Kupchan. He's a senior fellow for Europe with the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's former director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Charles Kupchan, a European expert with the Council on Foreign Relations. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev warned that NATO airstrikes would cast a very dark shadow over the relationship between the United States and Russia. Mm-hmm. Why is Russia so opposed to military intervention?
In my mind, it's fundamentally a question of coalition politics and of the ability of the reformers in Russia to stay on the to stay afloat, basically. And what has emerged since the recent elections and the strong vote for Zhirinovsky, and then more recently the defection of reformers from Yeltsin's cabinet, is, I think, a very tenuous position in which those people who want to ensure that reform effort moves and that those true democratic reformers stay in power have to be very careful about giving fuel to parties and individuals who are more nationalistic, more conservative in orientation. And so I think part of this is a political calculus in the sense that even if NATO airstrikes are carried out, if Yeltsin, if Kozyrev distance themselves from those airstrikes, they can at least show that they didn't approve of them, they didn't participate in them, and that then sets up a situation in which those airstrikes are less costly to the reformers and the democrats in Russia. And I think that's in large part what is characterizing the Russian position.
How strong are the ties between Russia and Serbia?
Well, there again, it's difficult to talk about Russia and Serbia because Russia is very different than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
The most potent historical ties are between the Russian military and the Serbs, and there have been historical cooperation and training and that type of thing between members of the former Yugoslav army and the Russian military. And one of the things that I think is characterizing U.S. policy here and U.S. thinking on the issue is, you know, what is the long-term role of the Russian military? Because it's important to remember that military has gone through basically a period of devastation in which its budget has been slashed, in which troops are being pulled out of various countries and sent home even though housing isn't ready for them, in which they had a preeminent position in domestic politics in the Soviet Union, and now they're in a position in which, in many respects, they're a backwater. And you therefore in a situation in which there is a potential for a backlash, a possibility for the military to reassert imperial ambition or to reassert itself as an important player in the domestic political scene. And that's why I think there is real sensitivity here about airstrikes against the Serbs and the possibility that the military will interpret that as a slap in their face.
Why do you think that the bombing of the market in Sarajevo on Saturday was enough to move President Clinton toward a firm stand on intervention?
Well, I think it was the crystallization or culmination of a period that began just prior to the NATO summit on January 10th and 11th, in which there was an increasing sense in Washington and in European capitals of the need to take a much stronger stance on this conflict. And it had to do with not only what was happening on the ground, and things were worsening on the ground, but it also had to do with a reevaluation and rethinking of NATO and of what Europe is going to look like 5 and 10 years from now.
Do you think that the NATO ultimatum is going to be a turning point in the Balkan War? And do you think at this point that the war could go either way, that the threat could help stop the war, but on the other hand, that military intervention could help spread the war?
Well, it's difficult to speculate on those issues, but if the past is any predictor here, I think that it will have the effect of containing the war, because the Serbs have been sensitive to threats by NATO. They have backed down when it appears that NATO is getting ready to carry out airstrikes. And therefore, I think the key here is following through, is making sure that the Serbs stick to the ultimatum, and that if they do not, following through with the appropriate use of force. I think that another important aspect of the initiatives of the recent couple of days is the explicit nature of the threats that are being levied, that the focus on specific miles, what to do with these weapons, how many days, that's important. That's a very important part of coercive bargaining and coercive diplomacy.
Why is that so important?
Because unlike in past months when we have just made bland statements about protecting UNPROFOR troops or stopping the strangulation of Sarajevo, this actually says you have to do X, Y, and Z 10 days from now or else. And it makes it much more difficult for the Serbs, number one, to pretend to comply, and number two, it makes it much more difficult for NATO not to act if they don't comply. And I think that's a model that should be pursued in the coming months, that coercive diplomacy best succeeds when there are very clear and explicit lines drawn, and that that those parties that are continuing to help negotiate should begin to look carefully at a political settlement and to use the increased leverage that comes with military threats to try to create a settlement that all the parties, number one, view as just and number two as acceptable.
I've been reading about fears that Bosnia will turn into an Islamic militant state, and that those fears have affected where European countries stand on the issue of intervention in Bosnia. What's behind those fears? Sarajevo seems like such a historically multicultural city, and a large part of the Muslim population in Sarajevo seem to be very secular in their way of being Muslim.
Yeah, I basically agree with you and think that those concerns are overdrawn for two reasons. One is that analysts argue that it is the Islamic militant states that are to some extent sending weapons to the Muslims of Bosnia, and that therefore they will use this as a sort of lever for spreading fundamentalism. And I don't think that has happened historically. And they also say that that the Bosnian Muslims will feel that they have been given a raw deal and that they will be militarized by this sense of having been left to the sort of prey of the Serbs. But I think that as you said, there is a long history of multi-ethnicity in the region, that the way that Bosnian Serbs identify themselves has not historically been only as Muslims. They have identified themselves as Bosnians, at times as Yugoslavs, as Europeans, and that the likelihood that this turns into a radical Islamic state is I think low, precisely because there are these competing loyalties and competing identities that have historically been powerful sources of community within Bosnia.
Charles Kupchin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Charles Kupchin just joined the Council on Foreign Relations as Senior Fellow for Europe. Before that, he was Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. An Chi Min was about to become a film star in China. She was selected to star in Madame Mao's opera Red Azalea. But in the middle of the shooting, Madame Mao was denounced, the film was canceled, and An Chi Min was demoted to scrubbing floors. Coming up, we talk with An Chi Min about her life in China and how her friend, actress Joan Chen, helped get her out. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Romeo is Bleeding, starring Gary Oldman as a cop on the take and Lena Olin as an oversexed killer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations has deployed its forces in strategic locations around Sarajevo to enforce the ceasefire and the withdrawal of weapons agreement reached with the Bosnian Serbs. The BBC's Alan Little reports from Sarajevo.
UNPROFOR say some 20 to 25 troops have already been deployed on the Mojmilo confrontation line to the southwest of here. A spokesman said it was the start of a process that would lead to the deployment of a whole battalion, about 1,000 men. Their task will be to monitor the ceasefire and to oversee the concentration of heavy weapons before taking them into UN control. In the Bosnian Serb capital, Pale, a spokesman for the leadership said the Serbs would not cooperate. "We will not move our artillery an inch," he said. "We are ready to retaliate, to respond by all means." Asked whether the Serbs were cooperating with today's initial deployment, an UNPROFOR spokesman said, "On the ground, there doesn't seem to be a problem." The Bosnian government remains sceptical. They see the agreement as an attempt by the UN to get itself off the airstrike's hook without lifting the siege. One official said today's deployment was no more than a circus.
Alan Little reporting. The United States and Japan have opened last-minute trade talks. The Japanese foreign minister says both sides are determined to get an agreement. Officials are anxious to clinch some kind of accord before Presidents Clinton and Hosokawa meet tomorrow at the White House. The United States insists that Japan set numbered goals to make sure that it really opens its markets to foreign goods. But Japan is refusing. Tokyo says there is no guarantee the goals will become strict targets that must be met no matter what. Neither side looks like it will give in. The U.S. Olympic Committee says it will contest a $20 million lawsuit brought by figure skater Tanya Harding. Harding has filed an injunction barring the USOC from holding a hearing to determine her status for the Olympics. NPR's Mark Schramm reports from Lillehammer, Norway.
USOC official Mike Moran today defended his committee's right to hold the disciplinary hearing, scheduled for Tuesday in Oslo. Moran said such a hearing is required in the USOC's charter and that Harding's rights would not be compromised.
The burden of proof is on the United States Olympic Committee, not Ms. Harding.
Harding was asked to attend the hearing. Mike Moran says Harding's ex-husband, Jeff Galluli, who admitted involvement in the incident, was not. Meanwhile, Nancy Kerrigan arrived in Oslo today and was rushed through the airport in what one official described as a melee. I'm Mark Schramm in Lillehammer.
General Motors says it earned $1.2 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. That's the first profitable performance GM's had since the middle of 1989. At the same time a year ago, GM lost $652 million. Stock prices fell sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 36.5 points to end at 3,895. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The Better Business Bureau says the Toys for Tots Foundation has violated six of the Bureau's 22 standards set up for charitable organizations. The foundation is the main fundraising arm of the Marine Reserve. The Bureau says nearly $10 million has been collected in a national mail fundraising drive since July 1992, but no toys have been purchased with the money. The Washington Post is reporting investigators from the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Buffalo are probing the matter to see if the foundation's president diverted money. Astronauts aboard the shuttle Discovery are spending their last full day in space. Discovery's 8-day mission is scheduled to end tomorrow with a landing in Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The 5-astronaut, 1-cosmonaut crew is undergoing more medical tests today. Later, experiments aboard the Spacehab Science Laboratory will be stowed, and the crew will prepare for tomorrow's journey back to Earth. Yesterday, astronauts released metal balls into space to test and calibrate tracking stations below. The data will be used to track space debris that may pose danger to shuttles or an orbiting space station. The crew also sent a German research satellite on its way that's designed to study cosmic dust. The primary goal of the mission, however, had to be scrubbed because of technical problems with the Wakefield Science Satellite. The satellite was designed to produce an ultra-vacuum in its wake, where thin, pure semiconductor material was to have been produced. Discovery is scheduled to land tomorrow afternoon at the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
A bad storm that swept across the plains and the East Coast is being followed by a cold snap. The new storm is dumping ice and snow. It's bringing single-digit temperatures from New York to Virginia. Southern states are coated with freezing rain. The dangerous ice is closing stores, schools, and making travel treacherous. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Anchi Min, was groomed to be a film star in China. She was selected from among thousands of women to star in Madame Mao's opera Red Azalea. The heroine represented Madame Mao's ideal of the new proletarian woman, willing to sacrifice everything for the ideals of communism. But as you'll hear, instead of becoming a cultural hero, Anchi Min was punished. In 1984, with the help of actress Joan Chen, Anchi Min emigrated to America. She now lives in Chicago with her husband and child. Her new memoir, Red Azalea, is about her life in China. As a girl, Anchi Min was leader of the Little Red Guard. In 1974, at the age of 17, she was sent to a work farm called Red Fire Farm. 2 years later, she was transferred to a Shanghai film studio to study acting. She told me why she was chosen to move from the work farm to the studio.
It was because I had a working class face.
What does that mean?
Well, that means everything on my feature that's against traditional Chinese beauty. And the Chinese tradition beauty was supposed to have slanting eyes and delicate small nose and porcelain-like skin and cherry mouth and slim body. And for me, because of the weather beaten situation at the farm, I had a bull like eyes and a big nose and big mouth and tough skin. And because of the working, the labor on my body was very thick, and there's no lines, you know. So I was 150 pounds.
So this all worked in your favor?
Yes. And I had a good political record, and they found no landlords and no capitalists in my family background, and I knew no acting.
So it was good that there were no capitalists in your background, but it was also good that you knew no acting?
Right.
Why was it good that you knew no acting?
Because that means I was a piece of white paper. They can draw any color they want on it to make me what they wanted.
When you got to the film studio, what was the acting training like?
The acting training was mostly we were put to study the current politics and to be trained to read all these instructions, political situation, and we were told that we are here to take over the screen to project this new image. And the acting lessons was like they tested my ability to learn. So they told me that to drink a cup of water. They gave me an empty mug And I took the mug and I pretended I was drinking water, and they said, stop there, you're doing it wrong. Because you had your little finger tilted up, and that looks like a Miss Bourgeoisie who had a tons of spare time. And the correct way to drink it is to grab the mug and drink it down in one breath and wipe your mouth with your sleeves.
What was the competition like for the role of Red Azalea?
Actually, it wasn't even between the chosen ones. It was more about the teacher, because the teacher who brought to me to teach me, they hated me, and that was something I did not expect. Because they are the old ones. They graduated from a film school in the 60s, and they were at their 30s, and they had a traditional Chinese beauty looking, and they knew acting skill. And they were supposed to teach me to manage this acting craft and to take over. So they will be out of job once they get me ready. So they try to bring me down, but they have this responsibility from the party upstairs. If these teachers, they say something wrong, and the party will punish them. And so they figure out a way to be more of a revolutionary than I would. So they will accuse me by saying, you have dark shadows around your eyes. Do you have a boyfriend? And are you getting these letters from Red Fire Farm? Who is that person? So they can just nail me down and in, you know, these personal things, and to be able to say that she's not a pure revolutionary.
So you were judged according to your behavior as opposed to judged according to your acting talents.
That's right.
Did you want the part?
Yeah, I wanted the part desperately.
Why?
Because it was my future, and I knew that's the only chance, that if I fail, I will be sent back to the Red Fire Farm.
Back to the work farm?
Yes.
And if you got the part, what did you think would happen to you?
Well, I knew like what happened to my neighborhood was when I was chosen and the news was spread, and the neighbor would come and wait at my land. They say we wanted to see the future movie star, and there's lots a crowd of people. When I step out, they were disappointed. So they say she's not good looking at all, because people don't care how you look. They have their own judgment on how beauty should supposed to be. And I had this working class face with weather-beaten face, and just walked away. But I knew that it was something that would lead me to this glory. And I saw posters of my face in the bookstore.
What did that feel like?
I had a great dreams every night. I thought, you know, going to be on the screen, big screen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is An Chi Min. She's written a memoir called Red Azalea about growing up in China during the Cultural Revolution, being sent to a work farm, and then being cast in the role of the lead in Madame Mao's opera Red Azalea, and what all those experiences were like. She's now living in the United States. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is An Chi Min. At the age of 17, she was moved from a Chinese work farm to a Shanghai film studio, where she auditioned to star in a proletarian opera. Well, what happened was you didn't get the part the first time around, mm-hmm. but then you actually ended up becoming close friends and then having an affair with the supervisor. And there was dissatisfaction with the woman who got the part. She was released, and then you got the part of Red Azalea. Mm-hmm. And as you were making the movie, Mao died.
Right.
And what impact did that have on the film?
It went very slowly, and I just knew that the fact that Mao died is not going to do me good.
Why not?
Because it was said that Madame Mao actually did the murder, and she bought Mao's doctor, but these are just gossips. In China, often gossip becomes the real news. And we read the news backwards. If they say Mao is very healthy, and then we knew that Mao is fading. So I heard that Mao and his wife was having this infight. And soon after Mao died, so the rumor more about Mao's wife's trouble, and she was going to get arrested, and she's going to get burned, you know, all these things. And then a month later, it happened. She was arrested.
How much of the movie had you completed when Madame Mao was arrested?
I don't know, because the script never handed to me in a complete version.
Oh, so you don't even know right how far you were, but the movie was not completed.
No,
so
not
you,
at all.
So you never really got your chance to make the movie or be a film star.
No.
What happened to you when she was denounced?
I was punished in a very Chinese way. Nobody just mentioned it, and I was told that not to go to studio anymore. Everything else was going on because of the new government takeover, and there was a new propaganda has to be made to go with that situation. So they tried to put up a stage set about Mao's Long March, and I was put in the backstage, and I became a janitor and just cleaned the tables, cleaned the makeups and the clothes, and nothing was happening. And I just, every day, I didn't have any attention anymore.
So you were back to scrubbing floors in the studio?
Yes, scrubbing floor is the thing. But, you know, in actual situation, I was made to do all kinds of things, including the conducting of a battle scene. So I was doing the thing that an associate director was doing, because I would make a good labor, and I wanted to do things to regain the party's trust, because I wanted to save my family's face, and I wanted to be able to go to school in the future. So I did my best, but my credits was never... I was never put on the credits, and I was not allowed to go to university or anything.
So it was a combination of menial labor and true film work.
That's right.
Let's talk about how you came to the United States. You got some help from the Chinese actress Joan Chen, who had come to the United States. Our listeners will know her because she starred in Bertolucci's film The Last Emperor, and she starred in the TV series Twin Peaks also. So what happened? She wrote you a letter, and what did the letter say? First of all, you knew her from the film industry, right?
When she was 15 years old, and then when I was going down to the drain, and she was the only person in the studio who was, you know, from the crowds, who was sympathetic to my situation. And because we had a class together, we were both young, and we played like sisters and real well. And then she was told not to play with me, not to be with me. And of course, she didn't say that to me, because it was the conversation between her and the party secretary. But she still played with me, and they talked to her parents, because she was still considered as a child actor. And she didn't listen to her mother. And then the party told to her grandmother in a very serious manner. And so she was afraid, and she stopped to really, you know, to be with me. But when I was scrubbing the floors, she would come, and with five rice cakes. She was just coming to the studio, and she was on her way to be a movie star. And they say, you know, Joan, who are you looking for? She says, I'm looking for An Qingming's drawer. Where is it? They say it's in the right corner. So she just came and put her rice cakes in the drawer, and she left. And then I went and I found the rice cakers, and knew that she was my friend. And later on, she went on, she got China's Best Actress Award, and she wants to have her education. So she came to America, and she kept correspondence with me for 3 years And then, so she knew how I was doing, and I was on the edge of committing suicide. And so she said, have you ever thought of coming to America?
Had you ever thought of it?
No. I told her that I didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't know what life would be like over there. Would I survive? She said, I will help you to find a school that would not ask you to demonstrate your English language skill, and I know that you will paint the Chinese brush paintings, and give me all these things, and I will have a friend to help you fill out the application form, and about life in America, you have to work like everybody else, work as waitress in restaurants, support yourself, and I listened to her.
So how did you get out?
Joan Chen's sponsoring was really a big help because she's in America and she was big in China, and they want her to feel that China is open. And also, I feel out the party made me fill out a lot of forms saying that I will behave myself in the West and promise not to ruin China's image.
You said before that one of the reasons why Joan Chen wanted to get you out of China was that you told her you were on the verge of suicide. Why were you thinking of killing yourself?
Because I don't know if you heard this saying said a snake that goes to heaven can't go back to hell. I felt the same way because if I were at the camp and work out like everybody else the normal way, probably I would stay normal mentally. But here I was one moment brought to be the nation's, this image, and the next moment I was denounced, and I just couldn't handle it mentally.
Now that you have this book out, which is getting a lot of attention, do you want to write more, or would you like to sometime in the future go back into movies?
I don't know. At the moment, actually, I wasn't sure if I could write, and I have my agent, my friend Sandy Dykstra, told me that I could write, and she keeps encouraging me, and so I thought I would try.
Did you write it in Chinese and have it translated?
No, I wrote it in English. I wanted to write it in Chinese, but the language have this psychological I have fear because of my mother's experience. If you read the book, probably you know that in one spot that she was assigned to print out a sentence called "Long live Chairman Mao." A long, long life to Chairman Mao, and she was sick that day, so she misprinted one word, and it became a no-no life to Chairman Mao, and she got a serious punishment over that that had a very strong effect on me as a child, and I'm just scared of the language when it gets too very personal, especially something that Chinese are too ashamed to confront with honesty. And I think using English, I feel more free about my thoughts.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck. Mm-hmm. And I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
An Ximin's memoir is called Red Azalea. This is Fresh Air. We're one day into NATO's 10-day ultimatum to the Serbs. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about what has actually happened in and around Sarajevo, where UN forces have actually assumed some positions that were very perilous until the ultimatum that was issued yesterday. Also, a talk with NPR's Tom Gelton, who spent a good deal of time in Sarajevo, about exactly where these artillery positions are and what it would mean if the Bosnian Serbs actually withdraw farther away from the city. In addition, we'll be hearing from reporter Ira Glass in Chicago as he returns to that city's Taft High School, and news of Tanya Harding's legal battles with the U.S. Olympic Committee.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Hungarian-born British director Peter Medak made his first splash 22 years ago with the Peter O'Toole comedy The Ruling Class. He found himself back in the limelight again recently with two movies about British crime, The Craze in 1990 and Let Him Have It in 1991. His latest crime drama is set in New York. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Romeo is Bleeding.
Peter Medak's movies have always been stylistically noisy, and Romeo is Bleeding is one of the loudest. If Medak can jolt you with a fractured camera angle or shoot a scene using three or four mirrors, he'll go for it. And Medak likes things dark. He likes faces that are hard to see, and then, when you finally see them, he likes them to look grotesque. I personally don't like any of this much. And more's the pity, because Romeo is Bleeding could have been, and should have been, a lot of fun. The story centers on Jack Grimaldi, played by Gary Oldman. He's a police sergeant gone bad. In the first place, he's cheating on his wife with a cocktail waitress. But worse than that, he's on the payroll of the mob. He tells them where witnesses are being kept before being put into the witness protection program. Then the mobsters bump the witnesses off, and Jack gets paid. But now the crime boss, played by Roy Scheider, has a new job for Jack. One of the mob's best killers, a Russian beauty named Mona Demarkov, is getting power hungry, and the boss wants Jack to murder her, or else. The trouble is, Mona's played by Lena Olin, and no killer has ever been sultrier, more seductive, or more slippery.
What have they offered you, Jack? What are you talking about? All I'm asking is if Falcon's up to your price.
$65.
For me? That prick slid in the past. I'll up that 5 times. $325,000. Half now. Half on delivery.
For what?
Go to him. Tell him it's been done.
What's been done?
Tell him I'm already dead, Jack. Later on, we'll get ourselves a body.
When Lena Olin says stuff like that, she's usually half undressed, wearing lacy underwear and a garter belt. In fact, this movie has so many shots of Lena Olin in a garter belt that I kept thinking we were being tipped off somehow. I kept waiting for her to whip it off and strangle someone with it. No such luck. Still, Olin's tiger grin is the movie's best special effect, and she makes a great, ruthless action figure, a cartoon of sexuality and sadism. The trouble is, the movie isn't supposed to be a cartoon. That constant whine you hear is Gary Oldman's soulful voiceover narration about temptation and loss. The movie wants you to feel for Jack and his plight. And, terrific actor though he is, Oldman has never been a very sympathetic one. He's too cold and too perverse. The movie gets crazier and crazier, and noisier, with someone losing an arm, someone losing a toe, someone else being buried alive. And in the end, you want to say, oh, the hell with it. Take your voiceover narration and your 57 flavors of garter belt and leave me alone.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease, Peter Clowney, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from some of the great early rock and roll songwriters, Carole King, Ellie Greenwich, and Lieber and Stoller. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.